So this is a panel about C++OX. I'm sure we each have things that we'd like to say about it, but we'd also like to entertain your questions. And that's just a suggested topic. It could be all sorts of different things, but especially since we've been spending a large part of today talking about the new standard, the importance and relevance of C++, and how to use some of the new features, it seemed like a good topic for a panel.
So is the question about the order in which you think the features, or we think the features, are likely to appear, or the order in which you should press for them to be delivered by your vendors?
Okay. Yes, yes.
I think that what we're seeing, and which is reasonable, is first the standard has two main sections, the language and the library. The library is getting adopted faster. And in particular, even though some of it relies on new features like R-value references or things like that, a lot of those you can work around and simulate, so you can still write code you can support people writing code that often can't tell, sometimes can, but often can't tell, and get a pretty conforming library without doing compiled work. It's cheaper to do library work, so that's likely. Plus, many of those things shipped as TR1 as part of the library TR, and therefore have been out in the field a lot longer as people conform to that. So that's probably first. On the language side of the house, I think the major features that we've already seen implemented in major compilers, GCC, VC, are lambdas, which are now in both, R-value references, move semantics, auto, decal type. So those are ones that we are seeing in the field. Now, if you're using GCC, that means to use lambdas, you need to be on 4.6 or higher. And so there's a bit of an adoption lag.
4.5.
Are you sure it's 4.5?
I know it's before 4.6.
Oh, somewhere in there to use that feature. So depending on where you are and what version of GCC is supported by your platform vendor, because I know some of you need to use back-level versions or there's a bit of a lag, you may need to press for 4.5 or 4.6. But I know several companies who have pressed to upgrade from like 4.1 and 2 or even 4.4 up one or two levels just to get lambdas. And so you're seeing some pressure from compiler vendors there. So those are the first things I'd mention.
I would add sort of an oblique answer a bit. I don't want to look at you directly because I think it's something that applies to most of us. One thing I've noticed worked at Facebook on large code basis was a sort of boiling frog kind of phenomenon, which was very interesting. So when I joined Facebook a year and a half ago, I introduced a macro called auto with capital letters. And it has two arguments and essentially does what the auto keyword in C++ 11 does, which is deduce the type of the introduced variable from the type of the initializer. And it turned out that this macro, and the macro used GCC's type of, which was already supported by GCC 4.1 or 4.2, which we used back then. So essentially, auto x comma y was type of y x equals y. You see what I'm saying? Right, so auto essentially uses type of to deduce, to enact deduction. It says auto x comma y means type of y x equals y, right? So you get rid of expressing the type of y explicitly because you get to use the type of construct. So this macro has been quite the it really was the match that light the fire under the boiling frog, because everybody and their dog started using it, and then it was also the code base does auto this, auto that, because everybody loved it because they liked type deduction. At the same time, it had all the ugliness of a macro. So after a while, people essentially said, I'm fed up with this. So somebody, essentially people organically wanted to actively migrate towards GCC higher versions, which do support auto 2011 style. And somebody actually wrote a Perl script that transformed all of my auto macros into actual auto stuff. So essentially what I'm saying is that this particular little macro has shown two things at the same time. It has shown how good it would be to have type deduction in your day-to-day code. It has shown that it is worthwhile migrating to C++ 11 in spite of there's a lot of friction in migrating a large code base to a new version, even though it's minor. I mean, you know how how it's like, right? I'm sure you all know what it's like to have like 10 million lines of C++. Let's turn the switch to GCC and new version. It's just going to be a disaster. Well, the disaster has been handled and averted, and you know, due to largely that one feature, which is auto. That being said, people actually started using, after that they started using the new features of C++ a lot more, and there's a sense of relief that they don't have to use boost. That they, like, for example, they use unique pointer now, and there's, oh, it's in the standard, so that's good. There's a sense of structuring and relief at the thought that this is finally in the standard, as opposed to being a sort of an additional on the side sort of library.
I just wanted to add one other thing. First, I actually completely agree with her about sort of the order in which I think things are likely to appear. I think also that if you sort of say, all right, it seems likely that, as example, we're going to see lambdas and we're going to see R-value references show up sooner than some other core language features, and then you take Andre's idea of sort of building a campaign for using those kinds of features, I think it makes a lot of sense now, even if your compilers don't support these features, to start looking for places where they would be useful. R-value references are especially interesting because I think that a lot of classes, it makes sense to look at them and say, is this a good candidate for move operations or is this not a good candidate for move operations? Herb said something this morning, yet more misinformation. I'm sorry, this was actually an opinion. Herb suggested that you should teach people that you should just always declare the copy of the move operations. At least that's my recollection of what you said. Because move is an optimization of copy, my feeling is that for certain kinds of classes, it's no more efficient to move them than to copy them. So if you have a class and it's got, you know, 10 ints and 5 doubles, I don't know of a more efficient way to move that than to copy them. And under those conditions, it's just adding needless chatter to the class to add move operations, because copy would effectively do the same thing. So what that means is that some of your classes are good candidates for moving, and some of your classes are not great candidates for moving. And even if you don't know when you're going to be able to start using move semantics, it certainly, to me, makes sense, just as you're working on your code base, to take note of places and go, this would be a really good class where we'd like to have move semantics, and maybe even declare the functions and comment them out because you can't use them right now. And similarly, I think it makes sense to look for opportunities of places to use lambdas. Sort of say, you know, this would be a good place we'd like to pass a lambda to the STL or something like that. Another interesting thing that I noticed actually was in one of Andre's slides. More information, misinformation, but actually it's a different kind. There were a couple places I noticed in your slides where you were writing perfect forwarding templates, but the arguments themselves, all you were doing was reading them. And under those conditions, there's really no reason to distinguish L values and R values and const and non-const. They could have simply been passed by L value reference to const, because you were just doing reading anyway.
Right. But I didn't know about. I mean, you
didn't
can't guarantee
something?
I'm not just reading.
I'm just saying in the examples you were just reading.
Some particular
like
examples.
Like printf, I'm going to assume you're not modifying the arguments you're printing. Am I jumping off a limb here?
No, but actually there is constant.
As soon as you say that, he will find it. Will think. I bet you I could find a reason why that would be.
Actually, my broader point is that in the same way that we have had to learn how to judiciously use every feature in the language, once people start learning how to write perfect forwarding templates, because you can pass anything through them and they just automatically do all this really neat stuff, there is going to be a natural temptation to want to use them everywhere, even if it's not necessarily the appropriate place to use them. So in addition to looking for places, you say, okay, this would be a good class that's worth moving versus not worth supporting move, it's also going to make sense to say, oh, this is a good place where maybe we do want to use perfect forwarding or R value references, but this is a place where we don't actually need that feature. So I think that you can start training yourself to look for places where you do or do not want to use these features that you're anticipating are going to be among the earliest to show up.
I have a harder question for him later, but I'll save it.
For him?
For both of you, actually.
All right, questions.
You're not safe.
Yes.
So I think what you're saying is you're surprised that we haven't talked about the memory model, because to you that's the most important feature, and someone has a talk about that tomorrow. Yeah, it is more fundamental. Now, why hasn't, in terms of appearing in compilers, the reality is that most compilers already support something that's indistinguishable or very close. And now formalizing this will take it the rest of the way, but most people have figured out the rules that you need anyway. certainly on our compiler we have, and GCC and other platforms. We're codifying to some extent existing practice in a standardized way, but people have already realized that, hey, you have to have the following fences and semantics for acquire and release operations, mutex, lock, and unlock. Otherwise, your code just falls apart when you do any kind of optimization, breathe any optimizer magic near it. So some of that's already been done. Now, the thing I think that's been the most novel that is still being implemented, which is sort of part of the memory model, is atomics, which Scott will also talk about tomorrow. Those are not yet available portably widely. Implementations are adding those as part of the standard mutex and futures and threads and atomics. Those are the ones that I think most cry out for standardization, because today if you want to write lock-free code, you do platform-specific stuff. Or you use non-standard libraries and things like that. So that is really the new piece that I think you make a very valid point about. The good news is the rest of it is largely in place, and now we're coming with the standardized wrapper so you can actually spell it scd colon colon thread in portable code without resorting to local chicanery.
I'm going to take actually a little bit of issue with that.
Oh, good, because we've been agreeing far too much.
Gotta work on that.
I hadn't noticed, but all right, so tomorrow's music is going to be so bad. I can't even begin to all night long is what he's going to be thinking about.
Hey, that's a good idea.
You might get the Muppets.
The Muppets. The two old guys in the Muppets.
I can download it over the air.
But what was the answer again? All right, so actually, I agree with sort of the broad point, which is that compilers have largely implemented some of the memory model stuff. But I think that one of the reasons that the memory model was so important is because there are noteworthy deltas between what the memory model prescribes and actually what current compilers do. So for example, given that there was no memory model, different compiler vendors did different kinds of things. So as an example, there are specific semantics ascribed to volatile in the Microsoft compiler, which are very similar, but not the same as the semantics of atomic. In particular, there's no sequential consistency, which is guaranteed. So it's similar to the memory model. It's the kind of thing which is just different enough to get you in a little bit of trouble under very rare conditions. Similarly, and I'm only going to mention the compilers that I know something about, so I'm not picking on yours, I just have heard a few more things. There's no guaranteed thread-safe initialization of local statics currently. So those kinds of things are not present. Hans Bohm has written a number of papers documenting compiler optimizations. The ones he mentioned tend to be in GCC, talking about, for example, doing word tearing and stuff like that. So it looks like an operation. It's inserting reads and writes into what would normally be considered atomic operations, which is contrary to the memory model. I guess what I would say is the need for compilers to actually implement the memory model, I would say, is a little bit more strong than the way that you put it. I agree the compilers are mostly there, but that delta is a pretty significant delta, I think, in practice.
And I agree, and nearly everything you just mentioned is directly related to atomics.
Okay. Yeah, okay. It's a funny kind of thing because atomics is part of the library, but then there's special language rules regarding what you can do to atomics, which actually affects code generation, which is not part of the library. So atomics is a funny kind of thing where it looks like it's in the library, but it actually affects the language as well. So, but yeah.
The short answer to the memory model, the most important thing you need to know about the memory model, which Scott will say tomorrow, and therefore I'll save him entire 90 seconds of his talk tomorrow so you can go faster, is that when you look at your program, and you have the same memory location, which we typically think of as the same variable, same named object, more than one thread can access it at the same time. There's no happens before relationship either way. And at least one is a writer. That is erase. That is undefined behavior. Do not pass go. Go straight to undefined behavior land. And so that, and those are ordinary reads and writes. You must synchronize it somehow. The way you inject those happens before edges are using locks and atomics. So, no, actually, you do. A lot of people assume you get sequential consistency guarantees for ordinary loads and stores, and it's exactly the opposite, because otherwise optimizers couldn't do anything for you. And Scott has lots of good material on that tomorrow.
Yeah, by the way, that was a deliberate decision that shows reflects the C++ spirit as opposed to, for example, the Java spirit, because Java does its very best to even define the behavior of wrong programs So that actually, you know, incorrect programs still have definable or defined behavior. It's going to be erratic, but it's, you know, and erroneous, but it's going to be defined. Whereas C++ has decided, you know, I remember there's this discussion early on with Hans Böhm, and, you know, essentially it was decided that C++ can't afford on efficiency grounds to define the semantics of an important category of incorrect programs. So we're stepping into undefined territory. There's a question there.
What else is not yet available?
Using.
So template aliases, initializer lists are not widely supported. I should be able to think of five or six more off the top of my head. Equals delete.
Equals default.
Explicit override. Explicit final.
The entire threading API.
Delegating constructors.
Mm-hmm. Type enumerations. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Enum class.
Oh yeah. Actually, that is GCC has it.
Yeah, but are we talking only about GCC?
No, but I'm just saying. Yeah. If one has it, then it's not implemented.
Yeah. Yes, but they were talking about widely available. For instance, a lot of people. I'm assuring a lot of you. Let's show by show of hands. Target more than one C++ compiler. Use more than one C++ compiler. Yeah. Typically, because you target more than one platform. So how many of those are MSVC and GCC? Yeah. Well, so my definition of widely implemented, and not because I work on the team, is GCC and MSVC both support it.
All right.
Which is actually a very close set.
No, it seems pretty reasonable.
Tim?
Herb, when can we expect a complete implementation of everything in C++ from GCC?
We'll start with
I don't know. I don't know why they're dragging their feet so much. It should have been done last year. So the short answer, I can't speak for GCC. I don't know. I don't think that they've published any dates. And for Microsoft's compiler, we haven't published any dates. But we're definitely interested in it. Both compilers have actually implemented C++ OS features before standardization, which is like all of everything so far, because the standardization process won't be done until Wednesday. 48 hours from now, on the last day of C++ and Beyond, the final draft international standard ballot up and down, which we hope will be unanimous, will hopefully approve the C++ OX standard. And then, and only then, can we call it C++ 11 for sure. So we're holding back until then. So far, everybody's out ahead of the standard. And you can expect that to continue, so we're interested in it. But there'll also be a tail to catch up. Now, the good news is, I haven't answered your question, so we're working on it, no dates for you. We're, as an industry, we're in a lot better place than we were in 1998. In 1998, when the first standard came out, compilers were way further behind, or to put it another way, it was way out ahead of existing practice, much more than C++ OX has been. And I take that as an encouraging sign for the restraint shown by the committee, as well as the ongoing interest in C++ that compilers are actively tracking it.
But this is years, right?
I don't think so.
No,
I don't think so. I mean, honest, I think adoption is going to take multiple years, but I think reaching a reasonable level of implementation, I don't think it's going to take years. Generally, for two reasons. Reason number one is compilers are already already ahead of the curve in many respects. And second, as also Herb alluded, the committee has shown a lot more wisdom this time in choosing features that can be implemented, as opposed to exported templates and things that were completely almost unimplementable. And this time around, I can't think offhand of any major feature, be it in the language or in the standard library, that is going to be extremely difficult to implement. As you know, there was a case for C++ 98, so there are a few features that were very difficult to implement, such as, for example, partial ordering. When it came out, it was very difficult. It's just a bunch of code to write for the compiler writer that was extremely difficult, non-obvious, hard to get right. Not to mention, you know, as I mentioned, exported templates. It just was next to impossible to implement entirely. So this time around, I'm much more hopeful. So I don't think it's going to take years, quite to be honest. And even though let's say crossing the last T is going to take years, getting almost there, so virtually there that it's indistinguishable from being done, is going to be very, very good for everybody. And very, essentially programs are not going to care about the last T being crossed.
May I actually ask you a question? So I run the C++ Standards Committee. We're going to be having our next meeting next week. So starting Monday, a week today, we'll be in Indiana having our next meeting. One of the discussion points is going to be, what next? There are people who would like to see a cooling off period again, like there was for 5 years. We just on purpose didn't do anything because we were so far ahead of implementations. We wanted to give them a chance to catch up, to avoid having constant churn as people wonder, well, what can I really use on which compiler to have a stable target? There are other people who say, well, we just shipped something. Let's keep right on going and vote the next new features in right away without a break and invent more new stuff. I'm curious what you want. Do you want to have, say, and let me give you a few choices. Go right on, invent new stuff and start voting it in the next two meetings. Wait at least a year, or wait at least, say, 3 years, so that to have a more stable target. How many would like us to just keep on inventing language features right now?
Just keep going.
So I see that's looks like roughly one-fifth. How many would like us to take a breath and at least wait a year to have a little stabilization? About the same number, maybe a few more. And how many would like to see us wait, say, at least 3 years, say, for more stabilization, so the market has a non-moving target? A couple. Okay, so people would like some stuff sooner, but maybe not right away. Let's catch our breath, it seems to be. That's useful input, by the way. Yes. Actually, by the way, I should have been clear. When I was asking that, I was specifically talking about language changes, because that's what causes the most hurt and churn. Library extensions are always good, because you can just ignore them if you don't want them, right? Herb, more is better.
Do you have time next week to fix lambdas?
They just can't admit
that they've done it.
There's a question from a while back there.
What about debugging, blinking, and tools? I'll try to give a short thought just to not monopolize one sentence and then let these guys go. C++ generally is a complex language, so it takes longer to write tools for it. We generally don't, as we're standardizing features, we think about usability, about source code compatibility, and not so much debugger effects. You mentioned debugger because generally we have quite good debuggers. People like the VS debugger and IntelliSense and those kinds of things. But generally it does take longer with C++.
Improving support for debugging things like, for example, linker support, because it's always an issue to have extremely long symbols in the linker that GDB is like, what? I don't think that was a priority. So I'm pretty sure there's no significant increase in difficulty for tool writers with the new C++, but I don't think that was on the priority list most at all. So that would be the answer.
I think too. Let me just make really, because since you mentioned template metaprogramming, I think that if you look at what is in C++ OX, sort of with an eye of a template metaprogrammer, the committee added some stuff to take the existing awkward approaches to template metaprogramming and make it so you could do more of the same awkward stuff. Which is not a condemnation. The point is, I don't think there was any interest in their part in saying we want to recognize template metaprogramming as something which is important and deserves specific support, for example, for better syntax or whatever. So they added some type traits and they added some other kind of stuff. But if you look at the syntax for enable if and stuff like that, I don't think anybody's going to say this is a breath of syntactic fresh air. But I also happen to believe that template metaprogramming is a really specialized domain. And because it is so specialized, you are unlikely to see a widespread tool support for it.
Oh, can you put breaks in lambdas? Go and download the free Visual C++ Express that's been out for a couple of years. You can and should.
So the question is about concepts and why they're not in C++ OX.
There is a torch bearer right now in terms of good compilation support for C++, and that's LLVM, and that's Clang, C-Lang, right? So Clang essentially has gotten, it is actually on the envelope out there for making templates easy to debug and template error messages easy to understand. Anyone who's ever worked with Clang can testify that actually the error messages produced by that compiler are extremely well thought and easy to use. That I know that I realize that that doesn't answer your question, but what I'm saying is that if you're looking for a means to, you know, if you're looking for a ray of light with regard to debugging templates and understanding error messages in templates, Clang would be it. With regards to concepts, we've had this discussion last year. You haven't been here, but you know, essentially, it's it could be a discussion of arbitrary length, and the very short version of it is
it's like error messages.
Huh?
It's like the length of error messages.
That just like the it's unbounded. My opinion is that it was a good decision to not introduce concepts in C++ 2011, and I'll keep it at that.
When you think of concepts, though, they're a great concept, don't pardon the pun, but they were not ready for standardization. They needed more bake time for us to understand, A, what we had and how to use it to make sure the design was actually right, because it was a compromise of two competing proposals, and then various people ended up not really being happy with it, and it had been thought through about how to use it correctly. Also, implementation. Nobody knew if it could be implemented with sufficient performance. Nobody knew. How many of you, when you get a new compiler, if you try it out and it's 20% slower than the previous version for compiling your source code, how many of you would refuse to adopt it for that reason alone? At least some. How many, if it were 50% slower, would you refuse to adopt it for that reason? More. 2x slower. More. The best implementation of concepts, which could be improved upon, but the only prototype we had was something between 6 and 10x slower, compiling standard headers. So you take the same program and you rebuild it. Nobody knew if it could be done with sufficient performance to be commercially viable. We'd like to know those things before we put them in an international treaty. So, exactly. There was some sensitivity. So we really dodged a bullet because now we have a chance to make sure it's done right. Now you wanted a ray of light. Have people stopped working on concepts? Have they gone off in a huff after investing years of their lives and then seeing the baby put out with the bathwater? They have not given up. One of the reasons that Bjarne is not here this week is because he is in Palo Alto at a concepts meeting and just recently had another paper. And one of the things in the most recent paper I've seen from him on concepts, so the right people are working on it, it's good news as well, is that he's got a proposal where he feels that there are, I think the number was like 14 concepts for the entire standard library. The previous number in the previous draft standard before it was yanked, with the same concepts language design, was over 100 concepts, which showed that we didn't really know how to use the feature yet. So shows us it needed more bake time for performance and for understanding what we've got. But the hope is still there, and I think it's a really promising path forward, if it bears fruit, to be able to make template error messages much better. Now, in the meantime, do not underestimate static assert. Static assert looks like a tiny little feature. I mean, what's an assert macro? I mean, you've done an assert before. This is not a macro. And it lets you statically say things that you expect about your template. And that combined with type traits, very powerful for improving. You yourself can improve the template diagnostics you get by using static assert. Highly recommended, highly underrated tool you should rush out and look at if you haven't already.
Well, concepts are mostly for forking implementations and overloads, so static assert is a poor substitute for that because it's going to just stop compilation.
Now we disagree. All right, no, you're wrong, Andre. Concept, that was a joke. Concept is not just about forking implementations. It's also about saying, I've got one implementation, here are my requirements. You may instantiate me with anything that matches the following, right. And instead of getting some Byzantine 40-page long error message saying that deep in the bowels of my call tree, something didn't compile that I've never heard of, sound familiar, it would say, oh, you provided me a type that I couldn't add.
I'll take the high road and agree with.
So basically, will existing code have to be changed just to compile with a new standard conforming compiler?
Yes,
generally no.
I didn't notice that we've had a huge, we still have a huge migration in process, and we didn't have any trouble compiling. There's always these cases where I even forgot. There's always some minor things, but even on millions of lines of code, they tend to be few and far between. So I don't see that as a major impediment. Next question, yes.
Was the question essentially why was a seemingly complicated feature like variadic templates rolled out sooner rather than a seemingly simpler feature such as templated typedefs?
Yes.
Okay. I think it was a matter of time. Variadic templates have been long asked for and long in the baking. People have been working on them since 2003, I remember. So that was the first proposal. And the template typedef, it's been around for a while, but you know, it just didn't garner as much interest, and therefore it's been moving slower. There are a lot of things. I mean, you should know that all three of us have studied. Herb actually has created, and the two of us have studied the whole standardization process extensively. And essentially, what it boils down to is that there are a lot of non-technical reasons for a lot of things. They're just, you know, simple human reasons. And for example, I talked to Alice Dare Meredith, one of the people who proposed variadic templates and have been working on it for, again, for like 8 years now. And I said, why did you do it this way and not the other way? And, you know, why didn't you include that particular thing, which I think was essential? And he said, there was no time for that. We thought if we wanted to include that and go have it go through the Scylla and Charybdis of standardization, it just would have been too slow and it wouldn't have made it. So we decided to leave that to TR2, which is, I think, the right answer to your question to the audience. TR2 should be worked on because there's a lot of stuff that has been pent up. There's a lot of pent up work done by people, great work, solid work, that actually has been postponed because they wanted to make the deadline.
Now, by TR2, you mean the proposed second library extensions TR, so working on library features rather than not language features,
right.
But library features.
Yeah. Right.
Yes, and I think there's broad agreement that that's an extremely good idea, and I know many wish that we'd done more library work this time around.
Right.
Let me just make one more comment, because since you mentioned template typedefs, actually, it turns out that this seemingly simple feature, people have wanted it for a long time, but it started as a completely different looking thing, and what it ended up with is really quite different. So if you actually, if you have any interest, you might go back and just sort of search through the standardization documents to see what it started as and what it ultimately ended up as.
Right.
So it used to be simple, and it ended up simple, except that what it ended up is completely different from what it started out as for some legitimate reasons. So that's a contributing factor for that particular feature as well.
It's had its peak. And essentially, I remember like the last document was, we're sorry for not using typedef, which seems to the person on the street seems much more natural. Template typedef, it's not template using. Template typedef, we're sorry we didn't use that because it was the only way we could make it simple enough to be palatable. It just didn't work out with typedef as as an enabling keyword. It just so happened.
What do you think we will get wrong in C++ OX or the current C++ most often? He must have been thinking. Notice he has this big smile and gleam in his eye.
That's such a great question.
So you want to know how to effectively program C++ OX. Now, I'm going to steal a little bit from Scott tomorrow. Relaxed atomics. So they're in the standard. Look, we love performance stuff. If somebody puts something in front of us and it labels it, and this is, you can get a little extra performance here in certain situations, what do? We say, how often can I possibly use this, right? We it's like a carrot. Like, it doesn't matter if it's over the edge of a cliff. We want to go for the carrot. Relaxed atomics are in the standard only because on certain architectures, namely mainly PowerPC and ARM, sequentially consistent atomics are expensive. Even then, you only need them when you really need them, which means when an optimizer tells you to and you're in a tight inner loop. Apart from that, you should never ever reach for them because they're razor sharp. I mean, we live in a language with razor sharp stuff, and we glory in that. These are razor sharp with kryptonite dripping down from the blades. Have I been pejorative enough?
No, see, the problem,
is this will only encourage you.
No, see, the problem is everybody in the room is going, cool. That sounds so wicked, I can't.
Sorry, they're really boring, and nobody would. Anybody can do it, it's not interesting.
For what, predicting the future is tough, but I think that if you sort of say we have a lot of people programming in C++, and you sort of say we have sort of the normal people, and then we have the people who find things like template metaprogramming interesting. which is not pejorative. I mean, there are some really legitimate use cases for template metaprogramming, but there's an inherent complexity that goes along with them, and some people are attracted both to the power and to the complexity. That's a pretty small group of people. They tend to be important people who write important stuff. I think that people who are in that small group but who find complexity attractive, they're going to be all over relaxed atomics. For the reasons you talked about. They're insanely complicated. You almost never need to use them. And so certain people are going to go, I want to be one of the six people in the world who understand that. So let the mistakes begin. However, I think that for the normal group of people, the much broader group of people, my guess is that the kinds of things they're likely to make mistakes with is overuse of the kinds of things that you already mentioned. So overuse of move. Overuse of defining move operations, probably also some overuse of these template magic template parameters that are tref-refs, which can be used for perfect forwarding as well as for some other things. Because there are enough legitimate uses and they don't seem forbiddingly complicated, and we don't yet know, I don't think, exactly how to summarize when they should be used and when they should not be used. And I think that the kinds of issues that I brought up about when perfect forwarding doesn't work, I think that as we get more experience with those kinds of things, with these other features, we're going to be in a better position to be able to say, look, this is when they're appropriate to be used, and this is when they're not appropriate to be used. But unfortunately, the way we find out whether it's appropriate or not is by trying them and getting it wrong.
One that comes to my mind is shared putter. It's going to be, I hope, used widely by people, and it may be overused, because sometimes you should use a unique putter, and sometimes you should use a non-owning, an observing-only straight pointer. And sometimes you really should pass shared putters by reference. Somebody asked me over lunch, by the way, are there any issues with passing shared putters by reference on the stack, since to avoid the ad ref? In the extra section tomorrow, I'll make up some slides overnight. I was going to do a talk about that, and then the time filled up with other cool stuff like GPU stuff. But I'll make up a couple of slides to talk about tomorrow morning. There are two major issues involved with that you need to know about. But normally, yes, you want to pass them by reference, but watch out for two cases. So people will run afoul of those kinds of things.
I could attest that when we had some thrift serialization code that was 10x faster when we switched from pass by value to pass by reference of shared pointer. 10x in a core loop. So there is evidence, apparently, that such cases are important. I have three items on my list. One was Scott's overuse of R value references as a potential danger to watch for. The other two are I'm not that happy that C++ 2011 does not set a foot firmer in the ground toward addressing ambiguous gender types. By ambiguous gender, I mean types that can be used as values and as references. 99.9 in parentheses, in period, of such uses are errors, are just simply wrong. And there's a 0.0 in period 1 cases that are correct. That's really 0, right? And that's really 100%. So most of the uses of types that are have at the same time, depending on context or whatnot, value semantics and reference semantics are wrong. And what you want is either decide at design time whether a class is going to be polymorphic or a value type. And it's simply the C++ 2011, for all of its might, simply did not care to address this case. Herb mentioned earlier today the non-copyable, boost non-copyable thing. It has its own liabilities, such as multiple inheritance. And you know, you end up inheriting non-copyable several times. And even if you have a simpler inheritance pattern, it might cost size in your class because the compiler cannot apply the empty base class optimization. So it has liabilities. And I'm not sure that all C or many C++ programmers understand this issue and know how to design a polymorphic hierarchy properly. And there's a very heavy emphasis of C++ OX features towards defining value classes. And people are going to think, oh, so all of this the stuff I'm going to actually use in my polymorphic class, all of this R value reference, which has absolutely no bearing has no meaning for polymorphic values.
That's not true.
It has no meaning. Well, you use the word value again, and that could be confusing. It has no meaning for polymorphic reference.
Give me a second. And so people are going to tend to use features that are applicable to value types to polymorphic types, and I'm afraid that could become more of a problem. And last but not least, the demise of concepts, good as it was, in my opinion, did leave a void behind. And by void, I don't mean the void keyword. They leave a void of, you know, of power, whatever you want to call it, a missing feature, which is essentially easily matching templates for subsets of types, which I think is an essential application of templates. You want to match a template to exactly the cases it applies to, and enable if is but a palliative to that issue. I fear that this issue is going to continue being an unpleasant boat anchor to carry with us. Go ahead.
I'm not convinced that it doesn't make any sense to distinguish L values and R values, even with polymorphic types.
Okay, I can destroy over dinner, no problem.
This should be a fun dinner.
All right.
And one last thing. I'm sorry. I'm sorry to bloat myself, but there's one more aspect. Herb mentioned, in answer to this question, he said, you're going to design interfaces different because you're going to start returning by value. I believe Herb is mistaken. And
I'm waiting.
Here's the thing.
That was
people are going. That was it. That's about it. Next question. I have a feeling of the history rhyming, not repeating itself, but rhyming. And I remember there's this swap idiom that Herb very much popularized. But many people actually use the assignment by swap, right? You assign and you create a temporary, you swap, and everybody's happy. It has a cost. Has a real cost, which Herb never mentioned. And the cost is you have an extra temporary around, and essentially, it's. I'm not saying that cost makes the idiom invalid. It's simply a cost that need be mentioned. It's not. I mean, you're not saying it's free food, and actually they say actually you owe me $15 for that. So, and now I feel I have this feeling that the history is rhyming, for a simple reason that I would not design interfaces now to return big things by value for a sheer reason that for all our value references. Everything, there's going to be plenty of cases in which unnecessary copies are going to be created, and that should not be forgotten. Mm-hmm. Right? That should not be forgotten. I don't design and I don't condone designing interfaces that return big things by value, because one day somebody is going to assign from it, and the assignment is going to be inefficient.
Why?
Because you better pass the thing by reference into the function, and the function is going to refill the, let's say, the container, as opposed to assigning to it. So I don't think the cost of returning big things by value should be forgotten in the aftermath of the victory of our value references.
And just to drill on that and to get more and more detailed, because that's what we do, I agree with you. I think you're right, but there are two different cases. One is where you're generating a new result you're going to put somewhere, and that's where you pass in by non-const reference, say, and put my result here, have an out parameter. That's what out parameters are for. It's exactly the use case for out parameters. There are other cases where you take two inputs and you're going to make something new. And instead of and there it's return by value, not as opposed to the out parameter thing, but it's return by value instead of doing the clunky workaround that's error prone today of heap allocation just to return a pointer just to avoid that extra copy.
All right, agreed. Yeah. We all agree.
Well, I have to jump in here because I just want to
destroy.
Say.
Okay.
No, we were just agreeing.
You two can agree. So,
by the way, we just agreed. Short answers, one question per person, and now we're all kind of speaking like forever. All right, go ahead.
Andre, the master of economy of expression. So, I think that there is a danger in giving people an impression that somehow move semantics is going to make it so we don't have to worry about the cost of creating objects and copying them. It's not going to solve that problem. It's going to reduce the intensity of that problem, but it's not going to solve it, which is, and this is what I was saying earlier, I will therefore say it again, which is that I still think it's important for people to look at what's happening and say, you know, do I even need to create this object at all? The fact that it's cheap to move doesn't mean that the overall chain of events is going to be cheap. So.
Yes. It's like the insert in the middle of a vector example. It's going to be a lot better than insert in the middle of a vector of strings, but it's not going to be free.
Yeah, exactly.
I believe the question, just trying to rephrase it, is sometimes you want to pass an out parameter, a reference, fill me in parameter, and sometimes you want to return by value. But if you do both and can't decide, and you design an interface that has both, now how can you write generic code if one type does this and one type does that? Or if one type offers both, which one do I use?
I think essentially each company is going to choose its priorities and its preferences in its coding standards. For example, at Facebook, it's simple. We don't return arbitrarily large values by value. If that's correct, right? We don't return arbitrarily large types by value, right? And it's a very simple policy. And occasionally people say, they propose deltas, and I reject them because they say this vector has most of the time has five elements. And I come back and I say there's two reasons for which you can't do that. One, this vector may one day have not 5 but 5,000 elements. This is Facebook. Anything could grow out.
5,000 is a big number at Facebook.
5,000 just, 5,000 friends for Herb would be a big number. With his social life and all. So the argument is that one, the assumptions that apply today may not apply later on. And at Facebook, we've been with the back against the wall multiple times on that issue of making some assumptions that have just simply turned out to be wrong later on. And second, more importantly, it's an educational issue because if a rookie is going to see that code, he's going to, see, return a map by value. What's wrong with that? Nothing, because we have our value references now. So then they start returning really big maps by value, or really big vectors or other containers by value. So at that point, you start to realize that you're better off safe than sorry. On the other hand, some other company may say, you know what, we are well below the performance limits of our hardware, so we don't really care. We don't have that much data. So, for the sake of readability and ease of use, we're going to allow returning by value. I don't think there's a hard and fast rule. I think everybody has their own priorities. If you care about efficiency, I would simply recommend you continue passing out parameters into the function that fills them.
Just to summarize on out parameters, as far as I can tell, let me know if you think of other reasons. The main reason why you might choose to pass in an out parameter rather than just return by value now that we have move semantics is if you know that you're going to put it somewhere, you can use existing memory possibly without reallocating. If you're going to allocate new memory anyway, it doesn't buy you a thing.
Right.
So that's one litmus test to look for.
Yep.
Can you reuse the storage the target already has? If you can't, you might as well return by value.
And essentially, the classic story is like you read lines from a file and you fill a vector, and if the vector is available from the last read, you want to refill that guy as opposed to creating a new vector every iteration of the loop. So let's actually move forward because there's like four people. Yes.
So why don't lambdas have type defs for, say, first argument type, second argument type? I can't give you a specific answer. I'll think about it overnight and see if I can give you a more concrete answer. But if you were going to do that, go down that route, you'd need first arg, second arg, third arg. How many do you support? Because you can write arbitrarily large expressions. It's not like the days of unary function and binary function where you only had one or two, and if you had more than that, you couldn't even say those, right? Because even in C++ 98, if you took three arguments, then you didn't have an easy way to talk about that in a standards way, even using the traits idioms that existed at the time. But I'll look and see if I can dig if that was proposed and rejected. But it seemed like it didn't add sufficient value. Have you thought
of a use case where that would be useful?
I have a two-pronged answer to this. So I agree with Herb that it might have been simply a matter of people not finding enough value in it. But there's two other aspects that I'd like to emphasize. Number one, it should be understood that the Landa proposal has been developed entirely in separation from the Variadix proposal. And Variadix would be a very useful tool for expressing things like first or nth argument type, right? I mean, you know, without Variadix, it's a specific work. It's extremely difficult. And given that the Landa started earlier, it was an earlier proposal, and it was a sort of widely followed proposal that was independent of other proposals, it couldn't have said, oh, we're relying on this particular orthogonal feature to define, to insert type this in there. And second thing that should be understood is that Landas are not functions.
But they create a type, no?
They create a type that's anonymous. They don't create a function.
It isn't anonymous. It has a name.
It's a synthesized type, so to say. It's not a type that essentially each lambda has its own type. That's what I mean.
Each lambda has its own type. Lambdas are not guaranteed to have a nameable type. Only the ones that take simple ones without storage.
Yeah. Arm wrestling. So after they're done, what I'm going to say is, just give me a second. I'm just going to say. Lambdas are odd in that way, so you can't claim they're a function. It's not a function. I agree. You could think of ways, but again, don't forget there's humans involved and there's a deadline. And you know, simply people could not develop the Landa proposal to the extent that it was that absolutely perfect.
Some lambdas decay to functions. The ones that can.
I'm going to just jump in here because I think it's. I actually have a different perspective on this about the type defs than you do. The impression that I'm not on the standardization committee, so it's not my fault. My impression is that the people doing the design decided they didn't like the idea of having those type defs, probably because it's not easily extensible when you have multiple argument types. If you look at the new version of bind as opposed to bind first and bind second, if you look at function, they don't rely on those type defs and they don't generate those either. So it's a completely different design. So I think that the reason that they're not there is because the people designing it basically were hoping there would be no need for them. Now, unfortunately, there's still parts of the standard library that rely on them, and one of them is not one, as an example. So if you apply not one to a lambda, or if you apply it to actually a standard function, it won't work because it doesn't have the necessary type defs. But I think that the fundamental driving force was they said, that's not extensible, we don't want to go with that model anymore, and we know more about writing templates now, so we can write function, we can write bind that don't require those type defs, and so they decided they're trying to move to a world where those things are unnecessary. Now, as regards your specific problem where you would like to know what the signature of this thing is, you can do that yourself. It's not an easy job, but you have a lambda expression. You can get the class from that because it does have a class. Once you've got the class, you know it's got a function call operator. You can do decal type on that and then write your own templates. It'll pick it apart piece by piece. It's not going to be a picnic, but you can do it, I think.
Ah, but lambda.
Lambdas only have one.
Lambda operator, function call operators aren't overloaded. Yeah. Do we have time for one more?
Last question.
Let's do one last question.
Last question.
The question is, how do you capture enclosing scope variables? So the shorthand version for capture by value is in the square brackets that introduce the lambda, just put a single equal sign. And then you can say, you know, copy ampersand A if you want to capture A by reference or something. Similarly, square brackets with an ampersand is capture everything by reference. So your question is, well, if I capture everything by value, is there a penalty? Do I copy only the things that I reference? And the answer is yes. You're guaranteed to only take copies of the things you mention. So if inside your lambda you access outside local variables A, B, and C, writing the TIE fighter, the square brackets with the equals, is exactly the same as writing square bracket A, comma B, comma C, square bracket. It's simply shorthand. It will not capture D, E, or F.
So when Herb says yes, he means no, there is no penalty.
I'd like to actually, that reminded me of something I meant to answer to the question, what should we keep on watchful eye for as we start writing C++ 2011 code. I think one of the issues that may be problematic to understand and internalize for many of us is going to be that lambdas that escape parameters. See what I'm, do you know what I mean by that? Escaping?
That escape the scope.
Yeah, so essentially, lambdas are not dynamically allocated. They don't use dynamic, they don't, on their own volition, essentially, you know, escape their locus, meaning that they don't, if you capture by reference, which is, I presume, a reflex of any C++ programmer concerned with efficiency, they're going to say, I'm going to capture everything by reference. They're going to pass the lambda out of the function in form of a function, of std function, and that function is going to essentially squirrel away references to locals. And as soon as, of course, as soon as the stack frame is gone, the disaster is going to ensue. Such users are known to create extremely difficult to understand and difficult to solve bugs. And you know, it's just my advice to you to just keep an eye for it. Do not use lambdas. I mean, be very careful with lambdas that escape, that squirrel away a reference to the, you know, to the scope they're defined in, because those are going to be illegal. You can pass down as long as they don't squirrel away stuff beyond the existence of the stack frame. So you can pass down a lambda to sort, because you know that sort is going to use the lambda, but you know when it returns, it's not going to save anything, right? So sort is a good example of passing down a lambda that does a good thing. And when sort returns, there's no so-called escape. There's no storing an address of a local there, right, in a global, for example. But I fear that many of us are going to say, oh, let me pass a lambda here, and I put it as a member in a class. Once you put a lambda as a member, a function as a member of inner class, if that function has for some reason squirreled away some reference to some stack local data in its own call frame, it's going to be a disaster to call that function. So just keep an eye on it.
So you're completely right, but I want to make sure it doesn't sound scary or new.
Oh, it's not new.
No,
it's
because
just it.
I'll come right back to your example because it's a very good one, a correct one. I'm about to destroy it.
Hold on, just one second.
I'm using that word now. You're infecting.
No, wait. I just want to point out where we are. Andre said disaster will ensue, and Herb said this is not new. So, Herb?
Yes. You agree.
I'm just clarifying what's not new.
So, if ignoring lambdas for a second, if you have a local variable, let's call it local, int local, inside your function, and you say return address of local, what do? You say, oh, darn, I should not have done that. Why? Because you're allowing the address or a reference to that object or a pointer to escape outside the scope in which that variable was defined. Often we think of return statements as being special, but it could be writing it anywhere. It could be writing it to a heap location. Same badness. Passing it to a function that takes by reference, you need to make sure the function doesn't take address and store a pointer to it, right? Lambdas are just another place to put a reference. If you return a lambda, if you pass it to an async call, which will execute somewhere else outside your scope, if you pass it to and copy it onto the heap, if you capture something by reference in a lambda, it's just another place to put a reference. That's the way to think of it. So it's not a new problem, but yes, we do need as a collective, sounds very Borgish, to learn that this is another place I can stick a reference, and oh, if I put that ampersand, it really means by reference.
Right. I think that the slight difference is that it's a bit less explicit that you're escaping something, because just to put an ampersand stands for capture everything without naming them. So on this positive note, we should actually
let these poor people go.
Let these poor people go.